We'll come back to recess. Ms. Batiste, would you like to join us at the table?
Jen was going to be coming in here too, but she was still doing some rearranging.
Welcome to the committee, and thank you for joining us. I think what we did with the others, we just had you introduce yourself and provide a little bit of background and why you want to join the Citizens Board.
Thank you, and thank you for accommodating my schedule. I'm sorry I couldn't be here at one. My background is, my academic background is as a geologist, and indeed I worked for the Pollution Control Agency back in its early days. I worked there for 5 years in the mid to late 70s when Grant Merritt was executive director, it was called back then. And I have 14 years of professional experience in the environmental area and then about 10 years of volunteer experience serving on various commissions and boards that deal with environmental issues. A lot because of this. I can't tell you what an honor it is to be considered for the board. When I was with PCA and I was a geologist and then I was a section manager in solid waste, we had board members like Marion Watson and Steve Gadler and Dave Zintner, and they were role models for me as a young professional just starting out, but definitely role models in their dedication to the environment. So I hope to follow in their footsteps. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think we've met Ms. Batiste, but I just have some interest in what special projects have you worked on in many different fields that you feel were some of the most important in your life? The kinds of pursuits, let's put it that way.
Environmental projects, I presume. When I was with the agency, it was in the days when we were closing dumps and putting in sanitary landfills. It was in many ways a step up, but it has taught me that we have to be very cautious about jumping on the bandwagon of what we think is the newest and best thing, because we now know that landfills are a problem. And so that taught me a lot. I worked on an electrical transmission project where I helped coordinate the writing of a report on electrical transmission throughout the state. And that was important. I served on the Metropolitan Waste Control Commission, the old sewer board, before it became part of the Metropolitan Council, and thought that was very important. Served on the Metropolitan Council's Waste Committee, dealing with solid and hazardous waste.
Well, we've been, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Batiste, we've been busy working on those outdated dumps and finding the responsible parties, and when you can't find them, then finding a way to do it without them.
Right.
For a lot of years.
Ms. Batiste, what do you feel are the most significant challenges facing Minnesota's environment, and what role would you play in addressing those challenges?
You know, I think Minnesota has some unique environmental issues coming up, and this, like in the 70s when I was with the agency, it's another very exciting time, I think, for the agency. We've got the at least three big mining projects in northeast Minnesota either under construction or being planned, all the ethanol projects that are coming up. We've got the study of all the surface water and the necessary funding for that. That said, though, I personally think that Minnesota, like everywhere on Earth right now, that global warming to me is the priority. It's global warming is the priority.
And what would the PCA's involvement and particularly the board's involvement be in addressing those addressing global warming?
Promoting use of renewable energy. We will review projects that will either be renewable energy or ethanol, and also we will have our regulatory action to reduce greenhouse emissions.
Is cellulosic ethanol is in its early stages. Has any of the discussions creeped to the board level yet?
No, I am so new on the board. I've only been there for two board meetings, so I don't know. That is... That is what I think of.
Well, that's about as long as the issue's been around.
You know, when I say that I learned from the sanitary landfills, where we used to say that, we said a well-designed sanitary landfill will not leach, mm-hmm. and we were wrong. Mm-hmm. So I think of that now with ethanol, that we should keep our minds open to cellulosic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Minnesota is on the verge of not meeting the federal standards, federal air quality standards, and potential violation of the Clean Air Act. What should we do about that?
You know, I'm sorry. I'm simply not prepared to answer that now. I'd have to read more on the issue.
Okay. Well, we hope you'd err on the side of a lot. Further questions?
Mr.
Senator Bickerman.
Chair, are you looking for a motion?
We can certainly take a motion. That will not
when I look at
end discussion, but...
When I look at your resume... Anybody that can, for women, domestic abuse, is going to have my vote.
Thank you, Senator.
So I've moved that confirmation.
And espresso.
And be a geologist on top of it.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so Senator Vickerman will. What's that? Senator Vickerman will move that the.
Did the committee send the nomination of TCA board to the floor with the recommendation that it passed, that it be affirmed?
Okay. Does everyone understand that motion? Is there any further discussion?
If we do, even if we didn't hear every word.
Mr. Chair, I thought I was just saying it in your ear.
I heard it in the microphone, so it was good enough for me.
I don't think if you didn't hear it. We were just putting together the wording for a motion to for the committee to send the recommendation to the floor of Ms. Batiste for the MPCA board, and that the floor affirm the nomination.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
What did you say, Senator Scogin?
My LA just called and said that they're back on the floor.
They're back on the floor. Are they voting?
What?
I don't know how ready they are to vote, I guess. Okay.
Benny knows.
All right.
Just a second.
Benny, did you come from the floor? Did you come from the floor?
Just now?
Oh.
Should we call
that's what
it?
They're back in session?
Heard. That's what they just
they're
going
to call just us when they're going to
the sergeants are aware of us being down here, and they will call us for a vote.
All right.
Why don't we move to...
came to the house and got me.
Did we lose the people on the moose?
Shut the board down before I got there.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
We done the last.
We did Ms. Batiste, yes.
We did.
Just did her, yeah. Mm-hmm. Just finished it. This is the rest of them. I should put it all together.
Thank you for your patience today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cornicelli had an appointment over at the university, so he had to leave. So I can give you some brief background and try to answer your questions or get back to you with information if you have questions that we can't answer. But just to give the committee a little bit of background about moose, occur at the southern periphery of their range in Minnesota, and they have a broad distribution across Canada and Alaska. They dip down into the lower 48 in Minnesota and a little bit in North Dakota, also in the New England states and in the Rocky Mountain states. And in Minnesota, we've had two what we call disjunct populations, completely separate populations, the northeast population and the northwest population, with a gap in between where there were no moose. And starting probably in the... in the mid 80s, perhaps, I look at a little chart here. We actually saw an increasing northwestern moose population from the 1960s to the mid 1980s, and then from the mid-1980s to the present time, really, that population started to crash. And about 10 years ago, we participated in a cooperative study with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Agassiz National Wildlife Refuge, and several university folks to do a study of that Northwest population that lasted for a number of years, and the results of which were just in the last year somewhat belatedly published as a wildlife monograph by the Wildlife Society. There were some rather inconclusive results of that study, but there was a lot of mortality of moose and failure to reproduce of that Northwest moose population that was attributable to heavy disease and parasite loads, and also moose just apparently under stress. And during that same time, there was documentation of a significant increase in the growing season and a hypothesis that just warmer conditions on the southern edge of the range were stressing that population and causing a decline. On the other hand, the northeast Minnesota moose population has been very very healthy and thriving up until recent years. We still have a very large moose population in northeastern Minnesota. This last year, population estimate was about 6,500. This is a helicopter survey. It's a statistically designed, stratified, random survey of moose with helicopters and corrections for visibility and so forth. Does still have a significant margin of error of about 25%, but we estimate about 6,500 moose in 2007, and that compared to about 8,000 the two previous years. It's not a statistically significant decline, but it is, just looking at the point estimates, it's a decline of concern to us, going from around 8,000 to around 6,500. And at the same time, we've had a monitoring study of moose with radio collars, a telemetry study, and we've seen high mortality of radio collared moose, some of the highest non-hunting mortality of moose that's been documented anywhere. And again, that we've had a difficult time pinning that mortality down. It's a variety of factors, appears to be a variety of factors. Sometimes there's too much decomposition to tell what's gone on, but it appears to be disease, parasite, and there's some speculation or hypothesis that again, these moose, the fact they're dying of the disease and parasite may be just the last thing that's killing an animal that's under stress, and that we know that in warmer temperatures above 70 degrees or so, that moose, being large-bodied animals that live in a fairly cool latitude, that above 70 degrees they start to have to thermoregulate either by going into water or by panting, and they're not feeding actively when they're doing that. So there's some hypothesis that these warmer summers that we've been having may be stressing these animals, both in terms of just the heat stress and the fact that if they're having to thermoregulate by going into water or standing in the shade and panting rather than feeding, that it just may be reducing their condition. So at this point, we've continued the moose hunting season for this year. We don't believe that hunting is at all affecting this population. We have, as I said, around 7,000 moose, and we're between the state harvest and the harvest by the three Indian bands in northeastern Minnesota. About 200 moose are being taken annually out of that 7,000 or so, and most of those are bulls. But in a precautionary move, just because we don't know what's happening with that population, we have announced that for the 2007 season, it will be a bulls-only season this year, just to assure that we're not killing cow moose at a time when we're not sure what's going on with the population. So, Mr. Chairman and members, The Northeast population now is a, there's a concern there. It isn't clear exactly what's going on, but or if there's a lot that can be done about whatever is going on, but it is something that we are going to start a new survey of mortality of moose, looking at disease or other causes of mortality or disease in moose. But this time, the Northwest study kind of became tagged with the term the Moose Mystery Research Project, and there was a website out, the Agassiz National Wildlife Refuge. A lot of schools were following that project, and it was never totally solved, and we're not quite sure what's going on with Northeastern moose either.
What are the numbers with the Northwest?
Mr. Chair, we did a survey this last year, and it's difficult to find moose in the Northwest. Now, we back at the peak in the mid-1980s, we were having consistently estimating between 3,000 and 4,000 moose in the Northwest. Our estimate, based on statistical sampling, again, for this past winter was 84. It's almost zero.
So from what to 84?
From about 3,000 to 4,000 20 years ago to less than 100 this year. And we closed that season, Mr. Chair and members. I don't remember exactly when. I could probably look it up. But in the early 90s, we closed the Northwest season, and it hasn't been open since.
Was there a period of time that saw the sharpest decline?
Mr. Chair, the decline was pretty linear for about 20 years from about 1985 to the early 2000s. We don't have annual estimates since then because it's so low that we just haven't surveyed them every year because there's very few moose left to survey. But it was a fairly sharp decline over a 20-year period, but there was no time during that 20 years that they really dropped. It was just a steady drop-off over about two decades.
And is this also the disease-related, or did they just move somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, the one of the big things that was happening there that we haven't seen in the Northeast is that there was very low pregnancy rates, the lowest pregnancy rates that have been documented in moose anywhere. And that was somewhat of a mystery too. It was they did think it was due to the animals being under stress, and they had high parasite loads, high disease rates, and as I said in that study, they were just looking at the key points from the monograph that was published. They said the pathogens were the most prevalent proximate cause of mortality. Deaths due to starvation were relatively common. Pregnancy rates were among the lowest recorded for moose. Chronic malnutrition was observed. In the last 40 years, summer and winter temperatures increased steadily in the study area. And their conclusion was that climate was acting in tandem with pathogens and chronic malnutrition to cause the decline. So, and they documented a significant change in the growing season days during that time, and just felt like this was a population that was at the southernmost extent of moose in North America, and it didn't take much to push them, basically push the population back north.
Senator Scogin.
Are moose susceptible, Mr. Bogus, to TB?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, yes, they are.
Any indication?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, there is no indication, but we haven't done a lot of testing for that.
I know that habitat is somewhat different, but did the deer numbers change in northwestern Minnesota as well during that time?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, that's a real good question because there actually were, it was a little bit of a puzzle because there was this theory for a while that deer and moose couldn't coexist because the brain worm, this meningeal worm that gets into the lining of the brain is deer are a carrier and it kills moose, and so there was some speculation that maybe that was what was causing it, but there wasn't any good documentation that that was. But there was certainly an increase in deer in that part of the state. But back in the mid-'80s, there were lots of deer and lots of moose in that part of the state. So we couldn't tie those two together.
Could this be tied at all with wolves?
Mr. Chair, actually, kind of the hypothesis that the researchers went into the study with was they thought it was predation on calves by bears and wolves. But when they did the, when they put the radios on the moose, they found very little predation. So there was no, they actually expected to find that and did not.
Mm-hmm. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it fair maybe to think that, you know, the reason I asked this is I grew up right up on the Canadian border, and I remember in the 60s not seeing many moose.
Yeah.
They migrated down. Are they migrating north? Are you saying the weather's getting a little warmer here? I mean, is that part of the issue in the northwest part? Or?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, it's, you know, I wouldn't characterize it exactly as a migration, but you do see sometimes the distribution of species that are at the edge of their range, either the north edge or the south edge. You'll see that distribution shift over time depending on weather cycles. And weather cycles aren't necessarily the same as climate change, because you can go through, you know, 10-year drought cycles, 20-year drought cycles, you know, other types of cycles like that. So it's possible. We just haven't got data over a long enough period of time to know for sure what's going on. But we've seen the same thing with pheasants in the mid-90s where the northern end of the pheasant range got pushed back in the mid-90s, and you're right, back in the mid-60s, we were doing surveys of moose at that time in the northwest, and we were counting 1,000 to 1,500.
Yeah.
And then it doubled or tripled from that in the mid-80s, and now it's going back down. So all the moose don't necessarily move north and south, but they kind of die off on the south end or fill in on the south end, depending on which way they're going. And then now it appears they're dying off, and they're really not found in northwest Minnesota. They're found in Canada, yeah. That part of the country. So.
And Parasol.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogus, I was interested in the fact that you mentioned not only the weather that might have a factor, but is there any connection at the same time? Was there any connection found between weather and feed, because the pregnancy level is low and then the temperatures might be moving? Do they ever actually shift? I noticed you mentioned later after I wanted to ask it quite a bit of time before that, but that there is a shift when it's too warm for them. But does feed also change a lot, and does that attract them to move elsewhere or not? At the same time as temperatures and all the other factors.
Mr. Chair and Senator Parasol, certainly they will move depending on where there's adequate food. We did feel like there wasn't a shortage of good forage for moose in the northwest, and the fact that they're dying of malnutrition indicates that for some reason they're not eating enough,
right.
And that kind of makes you suspect this theory that they're too busy trying to cool themselves down to feed properly. There could be some truth to that.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogus, do we still have an elk herd in northwest Minnesota, and how are they doing? Is it parallel to the moose, or are they doing better?
Mr. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, yes, in fact, we've got really almost two elk herds now that have developed in northwest Minnesota. We had the Grigla herd that was a subject of so much controversy back in the 1980s that's kind of stagnated in that 30 to 40 range, and now in Kitson County, in the extreme northwest corner, we've got probably 50 or more elk, and there's some of them that kind of wander back and forth across the international border, but those elk have not been near as controversial. A lot of the locals kind of like the elk and are more protective of the elk rather than all the problems that the elk were getting into in the Grigla area. So we actually, and then there's scattered elk kind of all throughout that area, bulls in particular. And they're doing well. And, of course, elk, originally pre-settlement elk were scattered all across the Midwest and even as far east as Pennsylvania. And so they are a more southern species if the theory about warm temperatures is what's going on. They are more tolerant of more southerly climates than moose appear to be. And they are doing, elk are actually doing pretty well and gradually on an increasing plane.
Well, the elk population is going up.
Mr. Chair, the elk population is going up, particularly in that Kitson County herd. The Griglia County, the Griglia area herd is doing fine, but we did get some direction 20 years or so that whenever there's more than 20, we should seriously consider having a hunting season on those. So we have been having limited hunting seasons in that Griglia area for the last several years, where we've got around 40 elk, I think. I haven't seen the count for this year, but and we've been offering 3 to 5 permits.
What do we need to do now, Mr. Boggess, about the moose?
Mr. Chair, that's a real good question, and we're having discussions within the department about where we go next with moose. Obviously, we're considering moose habitat needs in our planning. If there's, when we talk about thermal cover for moose, it may be a little bit the opposite of when we talk about that for deer. We're talking about places they can winter and get out of the cold. With moose, we may be needing to look more at thermal cover where they can stay cool and still feed and things like that. They also need larger patch sizes of forest than deer do, and so some of that's a lot of the moose range we're taking into account moose habitat needs. We're giving those preference over deer habitat needs in that part of the state. As far as future research or what can be done, we are going to monitor the disease factors more carefully. Whether we're going to continue doing more telemetry, we're not sure that that's really going to give us more answers. It may help us document what happens, but we're not sure it's going to really offer more explanation about what's going on. So it's something that we are having some internal discussions about. We're talking about putting together a longer range plan of action for moose, but we don't have all the answers at this point.
Is there a point where you will consider closing the northeast season?
Mr. Chair, there certainly could come that point, just as it did in the northwest. We don't see an indication that that's imminent at this time. As I said, it's pretty clear to us that the hunting season is not what's driving this. But on the other hand, if the population is in serious decline, it doesn't make sense to keep hunting it either. But right now, we don't have a statistically significant declining trend in the population, but we do have worrisome data about mortality, and so we just want to be cautious about how heavily we hunt them until we can hopefully get more answers.
Okay. Senator Pearsall.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't think of this before, but as you were talking about the disease and not just parasites but disease, are there any alarming factors that you found having to do with maybe weather-related change so that the natural amount of organisms out there, or whatever, I don't know what the diseases are, but if they're organism-related and transfer of that or higher than their normal concentrations in the atmosphere or on the ground or anywhere, or human factors that promote some of the same kinds of spread. Are there any things like that that are, for instance, the higher development in some of those areas than there ever was there before? Or any combination of these things that are suspicious?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pearsall, there may be some things going on with parasites in the environment. We saw a big decline in that. In fact, we closed the season 1 year about 15 years ago in that northeast population because the winter ticks just had a huge infestation. We had a mild winter, and they were losing their hair, and it was a bunch of pretty miserable moose, and it was having a serious impact on them. And they have a winter tick, and they can literally have tens of thousands of ticks. And it's just every square inch of them has all these little kind of what they call seed, common name seed ticks. But and it could be, and that may have been what we saw in some of the northwestern moose, is that they come into a fairly clean environment, they peak, they start to accumulate parasites or something in the environment that then drives them back down again. So that's what we hope to maybe find out with some of this disease monitoring that we're doing. As far as habitat, we think the habitat's in good shape, and the fire that you're going to hear about from Mr. Phillips, you know, will create a lot of forage for moose. The shade may be lacking for a while. There'll be a lot of food. So and we've had the blowdown area. You know, that's a lot of good moose habitat. So.
Can you talk about reseeding? Mr. Bogus, are you
reseeding the forest?
Yeah.
I would defer to forestry on that.
Hey, thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, there were some wolf management plans. If you need more, we've got plenty.
Thank you. Okay, thank you for your patience.
Put decoys up. Chair, my name's Olin Phillips. I'm the section manager for the fire management section for the Division of Forestry, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'd also like to thank the committee for its letter of support that the commissioner shared with me that you'd sent related to the fire activity in the state, and definitely we've been through a very difficult time here recent. My intent today is just to try to give you a brief update on the Ham Lake fire that's up on the Gunflint Corridor. And then just a little bit of a perspective on what's going on in the rest of the state. I've provided you this map of the most recent mapping of the Ham Lake fire, and you'll see the full boundaries of it. It's a very extensive fire, about 76,000 acres now, approximately 39,500 acres in Canada, about 36,500 acres in the United States side. This fire is, at this point in time, has experienced 4 or 5 days of very good weather for responding to it. And so we've made some tremendous advancements on putting control lines around this fire and putting out the hot spots, to the point that this National Type 1 Incident Management Team that is managing this fire right now may be released as early as this weekend, because they've pretty much accomplished their goals of getting this fire under control on the U.S. side. There'll still be continuing activity from our Canadian partners on the other side to tighten up their lines, but in the U.S., we're looking pretty good. I think the proof in the pudding on this fire is going to be today and tomorrow, when we have some very significant fire weather activity in the state that's going to ramp us back up with more winds and warmer temperatures and drier relative humidities. If our control lines hold well within this period, then we're going to be pretty confident that we've got a lasso around this fire at this point in time. Unfortunately, as I'm sure you're aware from the news coverage, this has been a disastrous fire, probably the most disastrous since the early 1900s in Minnesota. We've lost 61 residences, a total of about 133 buildings, which includes outbuildings, boathouses, things of that type, but we have not lost any buildings in the last 3 days and have no immediate threat to structures at this point in time because of the control activities that have gone on. I just want to clarify that you'll hear the term containment and how much containment is on this fire, and if you look at the black lines on that map, those are containment lines that have been put around this fire. I just want you to realize that we have had tremendous cooperation with the province of Ontario. They don't treat containment the same way we treat it, and they don't define it the same way. So when we talk that there's 80% containment potentially by tomorrow on this fire on the Minnesota side, there's also extensive containment on the Canadian side. They just don't deal with it in the same kind of language. So it's not that they're not paying attention to this fire. They're doing great work, and they've had some of the most serious late challenges on runs of this fire across their landscape, and indeed the last structure loss was lost in Canada. At this point, we will see this fire, and it looks like that from our weather projections, we see that a good indications that moisture will start to occur by the end of the weekend, that we may get substantial precipitation in this part of the state. Now, fire staff have always learned you don't count precipitation until it hits the ground, because we get a lot of weather projections. But if we get the type of precipitation patterns that are being projected for the coming week and the temperatures and the lighter winds, we will probably, this fire will be pretty much a non-issue by the end of next week in relating to threat to Minnesota at that point in time.
Mr. Phillips, is everything inside these lines been burned?
Mr. Chairman, what you find on a natural wildfire situation is you get a very irregular burning pattern. There is still burnable material within these lines that has not been burned yet. And that's kind of the pattern. It burns hotter in some areas depending upon the weather conditions and the convection that's formed by the fire. And so some is just strict black ash, where others you'll have standing burnt trees, and until some areas will even have green trees still standing.
But for the most part, everything inside these lines has been burned.
Have been burned to some extent. Some will be underburned under the tree canopy, but the land has pretty much been burned over in one way or another.
So, and Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
The Ham Lake, is that little lake at the bottom of the Boundary Waters border? Is that referred to because it's a starting point?
That was the starting point, and therefore it was chosen. Yes, ma'am, that's true.
Do we know how it started?
At this point, the investigation appears to be human-caused. There has been some speculation as campfire. The final federal investigation of that fire hasn't been released yet, but it was probably 99% that it was a human-caused fire. And they would then seek a responsible party.
Senator Scogin.
Given whether or not, I guess, it's a human fire, given the conditions, does the fire surprise you? Was there speculation that this was about to happen?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scogin, this is a very surprising fire in this area of the state for this time of the year. One of the things that we are seeing is the lingering impacts of the drought that continues up in that area of the state. It's intensified fire conditions. Several of us, after we have had three large fire scenarios in this area over this year and the last 2 years, one was the Alpine fire 2 years ago, the Cavity Lake fire last fall, and now this fire this spring. Generally, we consider fires of this magnitude occurring in the boreal forest area of this part of the state to be a mid to late summer event, and so this was a fairly surprising activity to occur at this time of the year in northern Minnesota.
Mr. Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Phillips, you characterize this fire as a lot of different kinds. You know, some were hotter and some were just burned underneath the canopy. So generally, would you characterize it as a kind of a productive fire, and that it is this kind of a natural, more of a natural fire than what I'm worried about, of course, is if you continue to suppress fires, and eventually you're going to have a big one that's hot and sterilize the soil. But you're kind of optimistic that this is going to rejuvenate the area in terms of the forest, or what are you thinking about here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Saxhog, fire is good in the environment, and it will have good things associated with this fire. One of the things is because some of this fire did burn through our blowdown area, as the previous fires have done, those are such heavy fuel loads that they tend to, even if they burn hot enough, will burn an organic material out of the soil. These sites will come back, but those that have been heavily burned, where they've lost that thin layer of organic material that they have available to them, will be a much longer restoration. If you've been in the area recently, since one of the areas that this fire reburned through was the Sag Corridor fire that came about in 1995. Despite being that late, we were just starting to see strong invasion of woody material into that fire. And now that's been set back again. So it can have some long-term delay factors, but it will rejuvenate, and it will be recolonized by trees and come back again.
And where on the map would that Sag fire be? Because there's Saginagon up here, and there's Saginagons, and there's Saginagon down here.
Yeah.
And there are so many of them up there. I always wonder who everybody's referring to when they said they were there.
The Mr. Chairman,
the left corner and then up
Representative Perso, If you look at this map right here, and I'll try to point, you see this long finger running up in here. The Sag Corridor fire kind of ran across from along the bottom of the Saginaw there up towards this area. And it's kind of in this area right here that it reburned through. The Sag Corridor fire was not completely within the fire perimeter, but it was partially within it.
On the reforestation, there have been emergent issues of what type of forest we will have when it grows back due to changes in the climate. And that as these fires go through, they will happen naturally, but this one, as are many, are man-made and prevalent opinion is that climate change is also man-made. What about the issue of reforesting, reseeding, restoring the boreal forest before another type of forest emerges?
Mr. Chairman, this is one of the concerns within this issue. We have the two factors that come to play here. One is the wilderness area, and the wilderness is being managed under that philosophy that this is a natural event, even though it was a human-ignited fire. They will allow natural processes to restore that wilderness area. And so probably within the area of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, you will not see any artificial efforts to regenerate the site toward any one desired species. In Canada, you're in a managed area. They may indeed go back in and seed certain species or try to promote certain species within that area. And also within the small strip of land in Brown, that is the non-wilderness corridor on the Minnesota side, that there will be opportunities for reforestation within that corridor. One of the concerns that we will have to address is the fact that because some of these areas have burned and reburned now over the past several years, we may have lost seed sources, the natural seed sources for some of the conifer species in some of these areas because of the intensity of the fire. What will happen is, and you'll see the invasion of the more pioneer species, we call them, like aspen, which is a definite pioneer species, windblown seeds, blow easily into the area and we'll reforest the area, and then you'll see a natural maturation over time of the forest from those pioneers into the conifers and into the maples and the long-term endpoint of these forests.
This is Lake.
I think it's just I know it's just, you don't have a lot to do with this, but I think we have to think about that wilderness area too and the impact that we as mankind have had on it.
Mr. Chairman, I share your concerns. We're in a society where it's difficult to declare something in the wilderness and not impacted by man, and therefore not to use man-made techniques to come by and try to restore it. But it's a philosophical debate of great magnitude, as I'm sure you're aware.
Senator Saxon.
And Mr. Chair, we were fortunate enough to see that DVD that was produced on the forest, and of course what we were informed of there was the fact that Bud Heintzelman was up in that area, the Boundary Waters, went over the whole thing and found it. There was a series of fires that covered the whole area, and in fact the Native Americans would burn forests periodically before they got so hot that they would, just to get them to rejuvenate. So the use of fire or disturbance just to make the forest healthy is something, you know, as part of forest management, it's very difficult in the wilderness, so to speak.
And so does logging to a degree. I mean, if we had not controlled this fire, you know, how far would it have gone? And so we do, man impedes on the creation of fire, let alone the what I meant to say was that we create the fire and we stop it.
Right.
And so this is all kind of manipulated against what kind of nature intended. And the biggest concern, and I totally agree with Senator Saxog, but now what's going to rejuvenate back is not what was intended to be there, but for what humans have done to the climate. So I think if we're gonna cheat in some ways, we can afford to cheat in others to maintain the wilderness. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Phillips, you said in your opening remarks that there are 61 residents that were burned. Are they just United States, or is that United States and Canadian?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Phillips. Fredrickson, those are American residences in Minnesota.
Thank you.
There's additional 22 structures that were lost in Canada that's known at this point in time, though their survey may be a little bit incomplete because they haven't had the opportunity to survey all of their island areas where they've got small cabins in remote locations.
Okay. Is there a property damage estimate?
Property damage estimates is approximately $4 million. I think you'll see that estimate on your information sheet that's attached to that map. And we'll provides kind of an estimate on property damage lost that has been experienced. Down in the final paragraph, fire and other information on that sheet, you'll see that they're estimating a value of approximately $4 million. Yeah, $3 to $4 million in value has been lost.
3.7, Mr. Chairman.
Also.
I think it's quite remarkable when you look at the context of it that the number of buildings that you saved and the value that was saved is quite large in relation to what was lost. So is most of the effort around the saving of structures or just trying to control the front of the fire?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, All wildfires across the nation go by three top parameters. The first is live property and then control of the fire. And in this case, for the first 4 days, the major emphasis on this fire was protection of property and allowing it to spread aggressively into areas that were not did not contain structures while we were trying to protect the structured areas.
And in the area of wildlife, do they see it coming and get out of the way, or is there a lot of loss of wildlife in this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, there's some loss of life. I don't think there's huge numbers. Like you won't see large distribution of carcasses left from dead animals in this. A lot of the animals have the ability to go underground and avoid the fire and have a fairly easy way of escape there. If they're the only threat becomes they get out of the heat, and it's a question of whether they can maintain an oxygen supply while the smoke is there. And then the larger animals will move. They'll likely move into the water zones, into the stream areas, and avoid this fire in advance of it too. So it has to be those that are kind of trapped unknowingly and get disoriented that would really be lost to fires of this type. So it's not as an extensive loss of wildlife in this incident.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Phillips, I noted from TV coverage that some of the places that saved were actually saved themselves because, and I don't know if you provided it or who provides it, but the homeowners took the necessary steps with sprinkling and clearing the vegetation away from the homes, and it worked out. They found it worked out pretty well. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxog, it's worked very well. These are called these roof sprinklers that were put on. This was actually an initiative that came following the 1999 blowdown as we looked at ways to mitigate the impacts of that blowdown on the future fire susceptibility of that area. You know, this has been it's really been a collaboration effort. Early on, FEMA helped to provide some measure on cleanup of the dead and down materials around these residences and cabins. And then there's also been work by the county and seeking and supporting work here and the fire department, just across the board strong effort. This area along the Gunflint Trail, it probably has the most per capita roof sprinklers that exist anywhere in the nation. And it's because of really the interagency, local, state, federal efforts to try to bring this awareness and bring it in place. And the local residents themselves have done great work in trying to address this and be prepared for the situations they might be.
What is one of those? Can you describe?
You know, it's just, Mr. Chairman, it's essentially a lawn sprinkler with a hose that runs up and puts it up on top of the roof. It's a rain bird sprinkler nozzle that is then powered by a propane pump, propane-powered pump, which provides a long enough a supply of energy for that pump to pump out of a local lake or a pond or stream for an extended period of time. And essentially, this was a technique that was developed in Canada because of the large wildfires they have. They have structural protection units that would move in, put these sprinkler systems up, turn them on, and then leave and get their people out of the front of the fire so that they were not risking life to try to save these buildings. And they proved their effectiveness there. And we have adapted that from there. And with some great local support, it's become very widespread. And I think you'll see it more widespread when we see the final revelation of how much impact they had.
Nobody died.
Nobody died. Very safe fire response to fight, despite some very difficult terrain. We've had a very limited number of injuries on this fire as well.
Thank God. Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's an interesting corollary. There's at Yellowstone National Park, there's an Old Faithful Lodge, a beautiful big old building. It's like a century old. The year before the Yellowstone Park fire, they put one of these sprinkler systems on the Old Faithful Lodge. Had it not been for that sprinkler system, that historic old lodge would have burned in the Yellowstone fire.
Did they get the water from Old Faithful?
It'd be too hot.
I don't know.
Not often enough. I don't recall where they got the water.
Water put on fires better than cold water?
Mr. Chairman, we also have had a strong effort by the local fire department and the forest firefighters there. We have a cache of these sprinklers that we also deploy, and we tried to deploy as many as possible on structures as this front came through. And tremendous work done there by those ground forces that had risked themselves to, and what was saved was because of the effort that local fire department personnel and some well-experienced local firefighters in addressing that.
One issue, members, is the homes that were lost along the lake shores. We talked about this a little bit this session with our shoreland rules and resorts and what happens if the resort is damaged or burned down like this. And I think for the resorts that were burned down, we provided the fix this session, but we will probably have to try and do the right thing for the homeowners who lost their homes along the lake shores as well. So
Mr. Chairman, being able to build back on the same footprint,
correct. We'll have to examine something like that. Many of them may be no way for them, given the size of the lot, to be able to go back 7,500 feet. So we're going to have to take a look at that situation. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Were there any resorts that were burned up in this fire?
I thought I heard 17.
Oh.
They would have been... Mr. Chairman, there had been small, and Senator Ingebrigtsen, there had been small to large. The largest I heard of, I think, was Voyager's Outfitters was impacted by the fire.
Yeah.
And which was really bad because they've been a great supporter of our fire operations in the last two fires and feeding our firefighters and helping to house them. And unfortunately, I know that at least part of their facility was lost. They were probably the largest kind of resort that was impacted there.
So, of course, our colleague Senator Bonhoff lost a cabin on Seagull. Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, some friends, daughter and son-in-law, have the Tuscarora Lodge,
Tuscarora.
And they just lost one building, but they were spared.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I don't know all the details on the exact structures, and I hesitate to say, but my understanding was that Tuscarora was not completely lost.
Mm-hmm. Is the dotted line the Gunflint Trail then up through this area? Is that Tuscarora up there near the seagull or near the end of it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, that dotted line is actually the international border. The black and white dashed line.
Yeah.
Well, the yellow is the international border.
Yeah, I know. I understand that. Is the black and white dashed line, is that the Gunflint?
That's the Gunflint corridor.
And would the Tuscarora be up near that end of it?
There's Tuscarora Lake right below that lake.
I see Tuscarora Lake, but I don't know that that's what it's on.
Maybe there's a...
I think it is on Tuscarora Lake.
Oh, is it?
But I'm not a local expert, unfortunately.
Okay.
Or, I don't know if it's a lake or if it's a water body.
Any other questions? Thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Members, I promise tomorrow is the last hearing.
Tomorrow?
What's left, Mr. Chairman?
What's that?
What's left to do?
We have LCCMR appointments.
Were they in the packet?
Tomorrow.
They'll be in tomorrow's packet.
Okay.
And then we're going to have a briefing on the 3M consent order. Informational.
Thank you very much.
Meeting's adjourned.